Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
You've been feeling strange lately, Barbara. Confused. This confusion has been transmitted to you from another time, another place, beyond human knowledge, understanding. Their forces, inhuman ones, out of this world, and they are unspeakably evil.
Well, I just...
Oh, my God, what is that?
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Rob St. Mary is currently on a sex tour of Southeast Asia. Joining me instead this week is Lost in the Statics, Josh Hadley.
Hello.
Josh, I know you just had a birthday, so I brought you along a little present. I hope you like it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, let's go ahead. We'll open up that a little bit later. Make sure I don't forget. I don't want to end this episode without that. So in the meantime, let's talk about this week's flick, The Visitor, a.k.a., and I'm going to have to say this very slowly, Stridulum, the 1979 flick from Giulio Paradisi. This is the time where I like to summarize the film, you know, and doing so with this one is a little bit difficult, but I hope folks can bear with me as I try to make some sort of sense of The Visitor. It's the story of Katie Collins, played by Paige Connor, looking oh so cute, a little girl who has special powers. She's a pawn in a larger game between good and evil. Good represented by John Huston and a bunch of bald guys that hang out on a roof. Evil has Mel Farrar and a very young Lance Henriksen in his corner. Along with these guys, you've got heavy hitter actors like Shelley Winters as a housekeeper, Glenn Ford as a detective, Sam Peckinpah as a doctor, Franco Nero as Jesus H. Christ himself, and Joanne Nail as Katie's mom. There's also a mess of birds, a bombastic score by Franco Michelezzi that tends to come on whenever John Huston shows up. Look, there's John Huston now. All of this... and so much more makes The Visitor one of the strangest flicks I've seen in a while. And I have you to thank for this, Josh. So please tell me, how did you see this flick for the first time and what brings you back to it all these years later?
The very first time I saw this was like on syndicated TV in the mid-80s, like one of those 3 a.m. things on a local TV station. And I was just drawn to how bizarre it was. And then I forgot about it. And then I'm perusing a VHS section of some video store back in the pre-DVD days, and the cover, and you've seen the cover art, that very striking eyeball with a garrote over a city, which has nothing to do with the film whatsoever. That just drew me to the box, and the back of the box had no photos on it, so I figured $1, what the hell. I bring it home, and it was one of those, oh my God, that's that movie.
I do have you to thank for this, because I never really heard of this movie before. I had seen that art here and there, but never really would have given it a try just with the, you know, disembodied eyeball with, you know, and lightning bolts and all that kind of stuff going on. I had no idea what it was going to be like when I finally saw it. And the first thing that strikes me when I'm watching it is just how gorgeous this movie is. It looks amazing. It looks so much better than it really even has a right to look.
And it's only a half to a $750,000 film too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is gorgeous. The colors just pop. The cinematography is great. And you told me that this is not what I'm watching on DVD, is not what you saw when you saw it on VHS and when you saw it on syndicated TV all those years ago.
No, we got what was called the American cut. The version you watched is what every other country except us and Canada got. Our cut was about 19 minutes shorter. Remember all of Franco Nero's narration at the beginning and his appearance with John Huston?
And all those little bald kids?
And all the little bald kids. That's not there. In the American cut, Franco Nero only appears at the very end of the film and has no dialogue. Glenn Ford's role is smaller. All the stuff with the bird and in his car, you know, where the toy he thinks it's talking to him, all that's gone. The battle between Katie and Jersey, John Huston's character, remember how that was all at the beginning, that battle on that weird alien planetscape?
God, yeah.
In the American version, that's all there, but for whatever reason, it's cut up into smaller segments and spread out throughout the entire film. Just little bits appear every time Katie uses her powers. You get 20 seconds of that, rather than having it all in one chunk. The two black comic relief tow truck drivers are totally missing. And most of Sam Peckinpah's role is missing, to the point where he's totally unrecognizable in the American cut. Remember the scene where he's all backlit and she's asking for the abortion?
Right.
That's his only scene in the American cut. You get no intimation that that's her ex-husband. You get no intimation that he thinks something is up. That entire scene with the black guy in the waiting room watching them have their conversation, that's gone. And a couple of Shelley Winter's things are missing as well. So we saw a very truncated version here in America.
So with all that said, I'm curious, though, and I'm not trying to be insulting. Did it make any difference?
When I saw it on DVD, the first time I saw what we'll call the European cut, it did. It made a lot more sense with Franco Nero's narration, the stuff with Sam Peckinpah, the stuff with Glenn Ford. It actually flows a little bit better.
Because there are times where this movie just still confounds me. I mean, I've watched it probably half a dozen times or so, and I understand what's going on, but it just still seems really obscure. You know, it feels like it's working with a mythology that it's sharing a little bit with me, but it feels like somebody somewhere, like when I first watched this movie, I was like, oh my God, I want to read the book that this is based on, because I'm sure there's so much more in the book that I'm not getting from the movie. But there is no book.
It's just a screenplay. It's a quote-unquote original screenplay, which I have a feeling was cobbled together from about six unfinished other screenplays. That's really the feel the movie gives you. It's really schizophrenic.
Well, yeah, like just the Glenn Ford part alone, it feels like kind of, you know, like they said, oh, hey, we've got Glenn Ford. What can we give him?
It almost feels like he's in a different movie.
It does. I mean, other than his interaction with Paige, I mean, there's, and even that section where he's interacting with her, it's just like, what the hell is going on here? You know, it just really doesn't flow at all. So, like I said, I wasn't trying to be insulting earlier when I was asking if it made more sense, because having a little less Glenn Ford, I'm not sure if that would make a big impact or not. I guess I can see, you know, not having his death.
His death is still there. It's just basically you never see him put the bird in the car or his constant looking down at it as the plot is sort of coming together in his head. It's just you see him driving down the street and he's randomly attacked by birds. There's no build up to it in the American cut.
Well, and they do know how to build some tension in this movie as well. There are some really interesting edits and some really good jump scares in it too. And the use of birds, I think, is very effective. I mean, it's a theme that runs throughout everything.
You mentioned the jump scares. Katie going from this sweet little girl to just absolute pure evil happens like that. And it really does startle you a few times.
It does, yeah. And then some of those creepy things where she's got those contacts in that make her eyes look kind of like
silver,
like she's a replicant or something, yeah.
And then she also has those very uncomfortable scenes with Joanne Nail where she's trying to be all sweet with her in bed and talking about bringing Lance over so they can make her a little brother. That's just creepy because she's so sweet in that, but you know there's such underlying evil in her character.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, completely. You know, this movie for me, it really ties into a lot of the stuff that was going on in the 70s. This was a late 70s film, like I mentioned, but there were so many weird movies that were coming out where it was like a mix of, you know, spirituality and science fiction and just these, you know, almost alien abduction. You know, it reminds me of a little Communion, that kind of stuff. And it, like, one of the things that really gets me is Shelley Winters when she's doing the whole thing about astrology and stuff. And it's just like, what the hell were they doing in the 70s, man? And this movie kind of tries to blend all of those things into one, you know?
I'm actually surprised we didn't see a Bigfoot. That's the only big 70s hooey trend they didn't somehow wrap into this.
Right. Because it was neat. The, you know, I don't know if you picked this one up, but when I was watching it and she gets taken away by the men in the white suits and everything, goes into that back of that truck and everything, really reminded me of Close Encounters of the Third Kind as far as the way that the lights were looking.
Well, even the way the truck was coming down the highway, I have a feeling that was very intentional because Close Encounters was, what, a year before they shot this? So I'm sure... and I'm going to use his American name because he's credited as Michael J. Paradise, the director. I'm sure that was intentional to go, well, Close Encounters is popular. Let's see if we can duplicate that.
You know, going back to the DVD, this movie, it couldn't have been that popular, but the DVD treatment of it, it was just like this deluxe edition, interviews, two audio commentaries, all this kind of stuff on there.
Apparently the movie was a much, much bigger hit overseas. Here it just kind of vanished because of Samuel Goodwin. This was when his company was not doing well. He was the American distributor. And it just, first of all, he ordered the 20 minutes of cuts to get it down to an hour and a half. So that didn't help the movie. And then it didn't seem to sell very well. So this was one of those, even on VHS, this was a rare movie to try and find. It got swallowed up by everything else around it.
Until you had introduced me to it, I had never heard of this one. But I was very glad when I first watched it. And I was really taken by the way that it looks. And then I was taken by that score, that really powerful and ever-present score.
And very 70s score, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is from the 70s. You'll never mistake when that score is from.
Well, and then it's even like inspired other people. There was a guy out there who's gone ahead and like done a almost like a sequel score for it. You know, it's like, man, so yeah, you know, it really has taken some people by storm. Some people really, you know, such as yourself, have just kind of really bought into this one and still love it.
Well, and then you also have that cast. How does a relatively unknown film, a $500,000 to $750,000 film, get the cast it has?
Oh, I know. That is crazy. Nowadays, just getting maybe one of those people in the film would be enough. But to have all of those people in there, it's like, what is going on? You know, all the way from, you know, Mel Farrar, very respectable actor. But then, yeah, having two incredibly well-known directors as actors in it, and, you know, a very young Lance Henriksen. I can understand getting Henriksen for cheap back then, but the rest of these people, it's like, where did this come from? How did you get Glenn Ford? How did you get Shelley? Well, Shelley Winters was probably, you know, pretty desperate back then. But anyway, I know that she was doing some Ford stuff at the time as well to kind of pay the bills.
Well, I have a feeling because the same producer that made this made Tentacles a couple of years later. Aseo, it's the guy that did Piranha 2. I can't remember how the hell to pronounce his name. Aseo Asantis or something like that. He also had Shelley Winter and John Huston and Henry Fonda show up in Tentacles, another $500,000 little knockoff.
Jeez.
So maybe it was a friend thing. Maybe they were just doing favors.
Right, maybe. Or maybe somehow through it being an Italian-American co-production, they were able to get away from the taxes or something like that, almost like, you know, making money under the table or something. But
or that most of the interiors of the house, which takes place in a large part of the movie, all that was shot in Italy. Maybe it was, hey, we're getting paid to take a trip to Italy. We just got to shoot in Georgia for a while, too.
Yeah, and I love how, you know, the opening of the movie is a thanks to the governor of Georgia. You know, it's like usually they put that stuff at the very end, but this one, before the credits even roll, even on the Italian DVD version, I happened to download that just because I wanted to see if there were differences. Even on that, the very first title card that comes up is a thanks to the governor of Georgia at the time.
Well, according to Page, he helped a lot with getting the permits and everything, and that this was a big movie to come to Georgia. So I have a feeling without the governor's help, they wouldn't have been able to shoot where they did and how they did.
Well, they did a pretty good job too of, you know, capturing a lot of exteriors of the city and, you know, a lot of nice shots of the skyline and everything. Yeah, you know, they did a nice job of making the city look pretty good and relatively safe, other than, you know, a demon spawn running around.
But she was such a cute little demon spawn, and she ice skated.
She was, yeah, and she ice skated very well. You know, along with the soundtrack, the other thing that's really neat for this movie is the sound mix. I don't know if you've ever watched this one with headphones on, but that's the way that I've watched it a couple times now. And everybody's got this great reverb on their voice. You know, it's very Italian sounding to me. Yeah, it's really got this great echo to it. So it sounds even more unreal than it is.
Well, and I would think if they're doing that to Houston or Nero, that they would try to do that, because I don't know, are they aliens, angels? It's kind of a little vague, but they're not human. Whatever they are, they're not human, but it's kind of alien angels. I always called Franco Nero Space Christ in this.
I could totally see that, yeah. John Huston Jersey, I don't really know where they were getting Jersey from as his name. You know, I was hoping maybe he would have like an angelic first name or something, but whatever. But yeah, he is the, for folks listening at home, he is the titular visitor that's coming in. At first I thought it was, you know, Paige's character that would be, but no, it's John Huston is the visitor, both to the United States and apparently to Earth as well.
And they even make a line of dialogue about that when he's first checking in at the airport.
Have you been to the United States before?
My first time.
What is the purpose of your trip?
Visitor.
He's got that iconic ass voice.
Yeah, John Huston has that amazing voice. You know, every time I hear him speaking, I'm thinking, you know, of Gandalf from the Hobbit, you know, speaking of elves, elven kings and one ring to rule them all and all that. But I have to say, Mel Ferrer has a great voice, too.
He doesn't really do a whole lot in this movie.
There are times where he doesn't even like move his face, which is kind of weird. Like he'll just be sitting there. Like there's a lot of close-ups of him in the boardroom scenes where he's just like, he's speaking, but no eye movement, nothing else other than his mouth is moving, which is kind of weird. But I guess he's some kind of emissary of Satan, or at least, you know, he's working for him here on Earth. So I can kind of understand that.
They mentioned this on the commentary track, and maybe it's something that was intentional, but it's something I never picked up on, that black people in this movie are the only ones that seem to be able to pick up that Katie is evil. That every single black character you see that encounters her gives her this weird up and down, like there's something ain't right with this girl. And it's only the African Americans, and I never picked up on that until they mention it.
Yeah, you're totally right, because there's the black guy that works for all the white guys that are in the boardroom. And yeah,
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, yep, who stops and takes a look at her on the court. And then, yeah, you've got the two guys who help them out in the when their car is, quote-unquote, stalled. And then, well, the one guy in the hospital, which is always just a weird moment. You know, they kind of stop the whole film for this guy there with this baby and, you know, kind of placating this baby. And, yeah, it's just, yeah, you're right. And I think that there's another one during the chase, right? Selling hot dogs.
Yeah, the hot dog vendor that in Jersey seems to know him, because they exchange like this meaningful glance, and then she tries to drop the scaffolding on the hot dog stand.
Right, which, you know, most 11-year-olds are wont to do, but, you know.
If they have little phantasm spheres in their eyes, they can do that.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with interviews that Josh and I did with Lance Henriksen and Paige Connor.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Forgotten Flicks. I'm Joel, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Jason.
The whole point of the Forgotten Flicks podcast, the idea behind it, was that we wanted to create something, a mouthpiece for fans of movies from the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, the movies that we all grew up with.
This was one of the worst movies I have seen in a long time.
You are full of crap. Are you being serious?
I will never, ever see him as anything else but Edgar, the cockroach guy from Men in Black.
Full Metal Jacket.
I love his playing that Edgar role in Men in Black was hilarious. Who do you think you are all of a sudden? I can't believe you hate this movie.
Everything is so contrived. Painfully so. I'm just going to read through my notes. And whether you remember the movies or you forgot about them or maybe you never even heard of the movies we're talking about, the point is that we're all keeping the memories of the movies we love alive.
Find us on iTunes or ForgottenFlicks.com.
What was it like working with John Huston and Shelley Winters and Glenn Ford and Mel Ferrer, you know, these huge names?
You know, it was really interesting because, A, I really didn't know who these people were. The only person I was really familiar with was Shelley Winters. So she was like the main thing. And I couldn't stand her. She was just a little witch, and she hit me. And in the scene where we're fighting around the table, I mean, she really slapped the crap out of me. You know, she knocked me down on the floor a couple of times, so I was pretty pissed off at her. I mean, I couldn't stand her. I couldn't stand her. I didn't talk with her. I didn't go to her dressing room. She had a private elite dressing room. And she just looked at me and said, I love scenes. I get to hit children like I'm some bad person. You know, I guess she was staying in character. I didn't understand that back then. But Shelley Winters really knocked the crap out of me. And my mother finally, after, you know, four or five times of seeing this lady literally hit me, my mother jumped in, you know. I mean, she went up straight up to Shelley Winters and the director and said, that's it. We are not having this scene anymore. I hope you got it because my daughter, I'm taking her away. And my mother was never the stage mom at all. You know, she had to be in this role, you know, because I had other people take me as a little girl. And I started, you know, doing commercials and doing more and being very active in work and then dancing. And finally, my mother had to take me everywhere. But John Huston was a dream. He sat down and talked with me one-on-one, you know, about my hobbies, what I liked, you know, really trying to get to know me. He was a blessing. He was so nice. He, you know, gave me this beautiful book and signed it, you know, because we were in Italy and he wanted me to know all about Italy and told me, you need to take the time, and told my mother, you need to take her on a tour. You know, you need to go and explore. You know, this is educational for her. So it was very sweet.
Did you keep in touch with any of the actors, like John Huston before he died?
And, no.
You know, Lance Henriksen, you ever run into him at a con or anything?
No, I have never. And the sad thing is that every time I found out that John Huston was in Atlanta, because he was in Atlanta doing filming, he was doing another film. I can't recall what it was. He was doing another film, and he was auditioning, and I begged. My mother called, you know, the After SAG agency, got in touch with him, and, you know, asked if he still remembered me and could I just come in and see him. And he, you know, he couldn't see me. He said that they were absolutely just swamped. He had no extra time for, you know, to see me, but that he did remember me and he hoped that I was well. So I did try to get in touch with him. Lance Henriksen, no, I have never been able to get in touch with him. You know, I did, of course, when I was in L.A. with Code Red and doing the commentary for the re-release, I got in touch with, you know, Joanna Nail, and it was very interesting. I got to see her and be around her and meet her husband and go to her home and have dinner. So that was great.
After the movie came out, was there anything, with you being so young, anything at school? Did the kids kind of, oh my God, you were in that really cool movie, The Visitor, or anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, I was like the star of Fayette County. You know, I mean, all my friends, the Fayetteville Theater had a big premiere for me, and we had a private showing there, so all my friends got to come. So it was really neat. I actually was working today and was working on a client who went to high school with me that found me on Facebook, and now we've kind of reunited our friendship, and she was just talking to me about that today. About, she goes, do you remember, you know, you did that movie, what was it? And I'm like, The Visitor, you know. She goes, yeah. She goes, my whole family went to go see it at the Fayetteville Theater. But, you know, I didn't know her really well enough at that time. She was a little older than me, so I didn't invite her to the premiere. She was talking to me about that today. I thought, how ironic, because I was going to be speaking with you guys this evening, so I was just tickled pink. You know, I said, oh my God, you're not going to believe this. This is just so funny that how this is kind of a resurgence of, you know, the popularity of it. You know, it's really funny. But, you know, I'm glad that they reintroduced the disc and had the European version, because the American version with all the cuts and edits really didn't make sense. I mean, I had to watch it 4 times as a youngster to say, all right, I might get it. Kind of a weird flick, you know.
Well, how difficult was it for you to go from sweet little girl and saying nice things about Joanne Nail and then to just go psycho and attack her? How difficult was that for you as an actress?
To me, it was just easy. You know, my mother was like my biggest coach. She was the one that sat down with me and said, okay, now how would you feel if you did this? Give me your expression. And I'm like, And she goes, now think about, you know, she would just tell me, your expression would be this way. Just really think about, you know, if this happened, what you would do. You know, so she was really my coach and inspiration, my mother. You block it and then you film it and then it's cut. And then a stunt double comes in. You know, I had a little stunt double that came in, of course, with Joanna Nail, too. She had hers that did the attacking and the flipping over the wheelchair and the dragging up the stairs. So it was very, you know, really interesting. It was easy, you know. As a matter of fact, my boyfriend today, he would go, you know, because we all watched the movie not too long ago, because I showed my daughter and her friends, and he's like, you know, you still have some of those same exact expressions. Like, some things are just natural; they just don't change.
Your stunt person, was it another little girl or was it a little person?
It was a little person. The only other person that I had, you know, the ice skating scene, that was a real professional ice skater. I mean, a young girl that was a, you know, up-and-coming ice skater that did some of the ice skating. You know, she did the pirouettes or whatever they're called. You know, she did those. And then I had a double for a little bit on the uneven parallel bars.
So how was it being one of the only kids that was on set? Was it pretty lonely, or did your mom keep you company, or how was that?
You know, we worked, and it was very tiring. I mean, I didn't get to do anything during the week. The only time that I had off was the weekends. I mean, it was 15, 16-hour days. So it didn't bother me at all. By the time, you know, I was done, my mother was rehearsing lines with me that night for the next day and just letting me take a bath and putting me to bed. It was interesting, though, that John Huston and Shelley Winters got put up in this beautiful hotel on top of the Spanish Steps, and we got put in this hotel that, you know, when you think of some of those Italian little, like, rooms and hotels where you have the single, you know, chain hanging down with the light bulb just exposed and there's no lampshade, and that really cold, barren hotel room that's 100 years old, that's what they put us in. They put me in that for a little bit, you know. Then my mother has a little temper on her. She's like, excuse me, their little English accent, because she's from England. She's like, I don't sleep like this at home, and we're not going to sleep like this here. You know, she was just a little pistol. So it was funny, and they finally changed our room. You know, we saw a little roach or something, some insect or bug, some creepy crawly creature, you know, crawl across the room, and that was it for my mother. She's, you know, and she put her foot down a lot. I mean, she was great, I have to say. I give her kudos. So then we got put up, though, in the same hotel as Shelley Winters and John Huston on top of the Spanish Chef. So quite an amazing experience for a youngster.
When you first read the script, did it make any more sense than what the final movie ended up as, or was it just as kind of batshit insane?
I didn't really care what it was. I was in a movie. I could have cared less. All I know is that I was this little demon, kind of like The Exorcist, and I was bad at first. I did bad things, and I blew up stuff, and then I turned good. And that's really the gist of all I knew and all I really cared about, to tell you the truth. Really, my mother kind of just went over everything with me, you know, so I would have an understanding. But it was very choppy. You know, you don't, when you're filming, you know, you may be in one spot filming the end of the movie, and then you may film the beginning at the very end. You know, nothing was in order. Nothing was in sequence. It was all, so it was, you know, confusing sometimes. We'd have to pick up, and then the director would really work with me and say, okay, this is what's just happened, and so here we are, this is what we're doing now, you know, so a little confusing.
Yeah, I was curious how your working relationship with that bird was. Did you have to do anything with that, or was it just trained to go certain places, or how'd that go?
I was trained to go certain places, but I got along great with it. I loved it. I would hold it and pet it. It was great. It was so nice working with it, and I always kept food in my pocket for him, you know, but the trainer was there nonstop right next to me, just in case. You never know about dealing with, you know, animals, especially, you know, animals like this. It was really interesting with all the pigeons that were attacking me, too, because that's the only thing that I really couldn't stand that I thought when I watched myself in the film, I'm just dying laughing because I was laughing then. I'm like, oh, my God, how fake. What a phony. That is, that sucks. You know, I'm supposed to be screaming and crying and, you know, yelling, and I'm like cracking up. You know, how do you scream like that? You know, I'm cracking up because I got a ton of bird feed all over me, all over the back. You know, and these birds are just pecking and eating that bird feed all off of me.
Did you get any other roles because of The Visitor, or did you just did you already have other things lined up after Visitor?
I did a first movie. I did the Great Georgia Bank Hoax with Burgess Meredith. That was my first role. I was 7 years old, and that opened up the doors to get the interview for this film. And then because of that, I was just able to audition. I mean, I was a working actress in Atlanta, and I worked quite a bit. I did a lot of commercials, national commercials. You know, I did Facts of Life, and then it just started from there, you know. Little Darlings, Fast Food. I guess I'm the Bee Queen. It's so funny, you know. All of this was just in my blood. Since I was a little girl, I knew I always wanted to be on television and be an actress. And I danced all my life, and I studied, and really, that's what my biggest love was dancing. And, you know, I went to New York, and that's what opened up the doors for me doing soaps and so forth. I loved it. It paid for all my school and so forth, but it's just a hefty career, you know. And I really would have stayed. I would have stayed and really pursued it further, but my dad got very ill, and I'm an only child, and he asked me to come home and be with my mom. And so I left my life, my career, everything, to be with my mom. And I have not been in it since. I mean, I did cheer for the Falcons. I became a Falcon cheerleader. And
I find it very ironic that you're cheering for the Falcons for some reason.
You're never going to escape the birds, Paige. You're always going to have that theme, it looks like.
I know. Grew up and became a dirty bird. You know, now I coach kids. I'll coach kids and, you know, kids in pageants and, you know, still love to dance. And I'm behind the scenes now, so it's very interesting. I stepped out from the front and then started learning, you know, what to do and be behind the scenes. Like, I worked at CNN, so I did hair and makeup for CNN, became an esthetician, got really heavily involved in makeup, all facets of makeup, so I love it. So my creative side is still very active. I think once it's in your blood, you can never leave it.
Just got done rereading the book over the weekend. Fascinating. Just an amazing tale. I'm amazed you lived to tell it in some respects.
Yeah, I kind of wake up in the morning, and before my feet hit the floor, I have an attitude of gratitude. Believe me, I'm a really happy guy. Yeah, we self-published it. And one of the things that we did was I went on a tour with all of the, you know, the fan expos all over the country, about 12 of them. And we put it into people's hands, which was great. We kind of hoped that by putting it into people's hands, word of mouth would get it out there. Because really what it ended up being, what we were hoping for, and it seemed like it really started resonating with people. And that is, everybody has a journey. It's how do you, you know, not only survive it, but how do you leave yourself open to getting educated, you know, to becoming someone who's available, as opposed to shut down or in jail, you know, or whatever, you know. I think isolation is the worst enemy in the world. And I never thought I would write a book about my life at all. But Joe Madry's got a silver tongue. He started, you know, our deal was that if we got halfway through and we didn't think much of it, we'd throw it in the trash and never look back. And then we got halfway through and the thing started writing itself in a way.
So we've got several films we want to ask you about, but hopefully you don't hang up after we ask about the first one. We're both very fascinated by the film The Visitor.
I refuse to talk about that movie. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking. Ooh. Oh, that's a turkey made out of cement, that one. Well, I was in my 30s then, I think. The girl was attractive, you know, Suzanne Nail. And there were, of course, there was John Huston, Shelley Winters, Glenn Ford, and Mel Farrar was in it. And I was the young stud, right, that they were trying to get to seduce this woman and bring about some kind of a space baby. I don't know what the hell it was, but I could understand everything up to that moment. When it became about some obscure Jesus figure that was bleeding, I didn't understand it either. But I did know how to hold my own. This movie was actually about budget. It was about a producer in Italy that decided the way to make a movie and get it released is to get John Huston, Shelley Winters, Mel Farrar, Glenn Ford, and all these people in it, and that would sell it. It didn't matter what the story was. He just was like throwing scenes at the wall and hoping they stick, you know. So that's the story of that movie. When I saw it, I was on Broadway with a bunch of friends of mine, you know, up in 42nd Street, and I remember the poster. It was lightning striking an eyeball. And I went, oh, man, I am so ashamed. It was like crap. And we got in the theater, and this black guy up in the balcony said, motherfucker, I want my money back. And I'm sitting there with my buddies, and we all laughed anyway. You know, Shelley Winters was doing her scenes, and I remember thinking, we're in trouble, man, because she had a little recorder that had some symphonic music on it, and she was walking around the set wafting it through the set to make the set her own. And then she proceeded to sit in a chair while her secretary brought her white wine. I was with a girl at the time, and the girl was taking pictures. And Shelley screamed at the girl, who the fuck is taking those pictures? And I said, it's my girlfriend, Shelley. And she goes, oh, okay.
Well, what was it like working? At least you got to work with John Huston.
Oh, yeah. My great story with John Huston was, I loved hanging around with that guy because he was really, you know, Lance, if you have to go to Mexico. I said, no, I don't want to go to Mexico. But he lived down there, and he had a house built where all the walls were just canvas that slid on cables to a central point. And at night, he'd be in bed, and a panther would walk through, or birds would fly through. And he felt very good about that. I mean, his life had gotten simplified to the point where he felt nature and him were one. But we're doing a scene, and he said, I don't want to come back, Lance, so let's just do the lines. And he turned to the sound guy and said, roll it. And then he turned to me, he pointed at me, because I had the first line, and he pointed at me, and I didn't do anything. And he went, well, what's the matter, Lance? And I said, I'm sorry, John, I froze up. I just got my first direction from John Huston.
I'm having a hard time fathoming a conversation between Lance Henriksen and John Huston, two of the best voices around.
Oh, God. He was a king, man. You know, he would talk about the simplest shit. He could talk about what he ate for lunch, and you'd sit there mesmerized by that guy. You know, he really was something. He really was. I would love to have met him in his youth. He must have been a feisty guy, like, you know. I remember them talking about Hemingway bringing hand grenades to Picasso, you know. I'm sure he was that kind of guy.
Well, I spoke to Paige Connor on the phone, and she said you were so nice and so fatherly, and you gave her such great advice for her career that she absolutely looked up to you. What did you think of Paige?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, I embrace actors. I mean, I really do, man, because I came from nowhere and started from zero and had to add ideas and concepts on one penny at a time. And so whenever I'm with somebody, you get a sense right away of what they're asking for, what they want from you, you know, and I was very willing to give it. I mean, we're talking about, you know, levels of experience. By the time I met her, I was fairly well experienced, you know. So you want to share that. I've seen other actors that don't share shit, and they end up drying up, you know, and I don't want that. I don't want that to happen to me.
The thing that really fascinated me about your book was just the level of preparation you go into in some of your films, and just, you know, from the tiniest things, you know, to just going so all out for the research that you're doing. It's got to be just so painstaking to put that much of yourself into your craft, but I'm hoping that the rewards are always justified for that.
Not always, but you know, even if you're a writer and you're going to go after a story that you're going to write, you have to go through, Joe, you could talk about that, man, because Joe reads 10 books, 15 books on a subject before he even starts to write. And so I think for actors, it's pretty much the same if you have any sense about you, any brains at all, because you do want to gather facts and as many tangibles as you can wrap your brain around, so that when you get into the construction of either a fantasy or a want a love story or whatever it is, that you have material to draw on that's got to be hung in facts to some degree, you know. So, you know, you make your choices, but I think it's not painstaking. It's more like you're savoring. I would rather savor something than to go through, compulsive nano-selecting, you know. It's savoring it, really, like a good cook. When they cook, they build a beautiful meal, and that's what you're trying to do.
Have there ever been times, though, where you've put so much into it and then either the role doesn't come through? You know, I know that Hollywood is just a rife with battleground stories of you do all this stuff and then the money falls through or something goes through. Or have you ever put so much of yourself into a role and then you look back and you look at the rest of the actors or the director or some of the other people that are around you and you go, they're not putting it nearly as much into this as they should be?
Yeah, there's a more difficult situation, and that is the god of all movies is the editor. And some editors will cut out your behavior, and some will cut out your lines, and some will, like I did, I was in Close Encounters, and I worked on it for 6 months. And I'm on screen exactly about a minute and 20 seconds. So whatever those reasons are, that's God talking, you know, by the time it's over. I hate rough cuts now, and I don't go to dailies because really it's out of my hands. All I can do is be subjective about my work and give them everything I can. And then it's up to them what they're going to do with it, because really it's a survival game. You know, when it comes down to the business guys and when Hard Target was done, I remember John Woo was in the editing room over at Universal. And I went to visit him, and in the time that I was there, at least three different execs came down to look at a cut of a scene, and they all had something to say. And I don't know how that fits, you know, as a director. I mean, I haven't directed, so it doesn't mean that I'm just a piece of meat. I have ideas and I share them, but whatever ends up on film, I have to surrender, you know, I really do.
How about when a script is just a complete mess, but you're contractually obligated? Like, I don't know your feelings on the film, but I think Alien 3 is a total mess, and you're one of the few people that seems to really be trying your damnedest to make this a good movie.
Well, Alien, you're talking about Fincher's, right?
Yes.
Well, he was so brilliant. I mean, when I met Fincher, he was a very young guy, and he was brilliant in terms of the way he talked to you. The way we examined a moment or a scene. And I thought he was just absolutely so communicative. He the way he talked and broke things down was incredible. And the outcome of the movie, even when I saw it, I thought it was so nihilistic. I mean, first of all, you crash and land on a prison planet. Everybody on the planet is either a rapist or a murderer. And then she goes to bed with a guy who's also a murderer, who happens to be this real pale British guy with skin like, you know, I mean, she goes to bed with him. And I thought, oh, shit. All the mystique has gone out of, you know, Ripley. And I thought, why? And then she ends up standing and flopping backwards in the molten lead. And I thought, whoa, this is really entertaining. I mean, it's like, what? When they had such a powerful bunch of films, you know, stacked up there. And but I thought that he did well with what he had and what he did, what he was trying to do. But God knows what the battles were on that movie. I heard there were many scripts. One was that at first they went to a wooden planet with monks on it. And I thought, oh, shit, that would have been a drag. You know, rag movies on space, you know. And then it turns out it's a prison planet, which is also like monks. So I don't know where that came from or what, but I enjoyed doing it, revisiting it. I remember Walter Hill saying to me, go to London and do it. You know, you have a cup of tea and a donut and come back. Well, it ended up being a month. I flew back and forth four times. I was grateful to be part of it, really. I mean, I met Fincher and I like his work. We're not really defined by a movie that doesn't work. We can be, I guess, but I never feel that way.
Do you ever get any crap from the stars that you'd completely upstage, such as Stone Cold? You are the character. Chains is the character everyone remembers from that film, not Brian Bosworth.
What? That's unfortunate. I gotta, you know, it's in the book. My mother loved that character, and she would rave about it. She said, "Oh, I love that James. I love that James." And I said, "Mom, the guy's a killer. He's a biker. He's a whack job." And she goes, "Yeah, but I love that James." And I finally said, "I met a woman at one of the shows, and she said she was in her 70s and said I love that James." And I said, "Oh, what's the story with this?" Because my mother did too. And she said, "Well, I haven't always been a good girl."
Did Bosworth ever give you any crap that you kind of stole his movie from him?
No, he thought he had kicked ass. His manager at the time was telling him things like, take two bandanas and hang them across the back of your rear end. You know, two bandanas, a blue one and a, you know, he was making up shit. And then that will become a fad. That's what the manager was telling him. And Bosworth to me was like a young John Wayne. I mean, he's a pretty nice guy, but you know, I mean, he was a young guy when he did that. And I don't know, most of my role I improvised in that movie because the script originally had that character only reciting from the Bible. And the guy who wrote it got fired and he was also directing it. And they brought in a new director. And I said to the new director, at the risk of being fired, I can't say a word that the guy wrote. And he said to me, it's Craig Baxley, who's a great guy. And he said, well, what are we going to do? And I said, well, look, I won't mess up with the narrative, which is, you know, where we have to go from scene to scene. But I don't want to say a word that's written in that script. And we did. We improvised the whole thing. We'd start off early in the morning with Brian Bosworth and I in a trailer hacking out what could we say to each other. And for me, it ended up working really well. I mean, I got very deep into that role, and I love playing that guy.
Just for folks at home, when they want to go get a copy of Not Bad for a Human, what's the best place for them to go to?
They can go to notbadforhuman.com and get a book and a signed photograph sent all in one. And that's a hardback version. Or they can go to Amazon and get it on Kindle, Nook, or iPad. So it's available all over the place. But that's the one on Amazon is a paperback.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. Josh, you did a man's job tracking down Miss Connor. It was a real pleasure talking to her and Mr. Hendrickson about The Visitor, even if Lance didn't have a lot, or at least much good anyway, to say about it.
Well, I have to give a little bit of credit to our friend Fred Fritz from the Erase Rewind show. He helped me a little bit narrow down the correct Paige Connor, because I didn't want to just start cold calling Paige Connors in Georgia to try and find the right one.
The picture that you found on her online was very nice.
She grew up to be quite a good-looking woman. And I know she hears this, I don't know if she'll be embarrassed by that or happy by it. Oh, because she was so nice when we talked to her.
Oh, yeah, super sweet.
And the funny thing is, she did not know this film had such a cult following behind it. I was the first person that's contacted her about this film, and she's like, that one? Why are you want to talk about that movie?
I get that a lot when I talk to different people. It's like, of all the movies you want to talk to me about, why that one?
They don't realize it's a good flick, though. And I wonder what Joanne Nail thought after all the time she has to get attacked by a bird while in a wheelchair. And
then, oh, God.
She is so abused in this movie. And it's all by a little 10-year-old girl.
Her getting pulled up the stairs.
she gets driven through like one of those standing fish tanks in her wheelchair, and then she gets dropped off of a staircase, and then she gets hung, and she gets shot, and then she gets raped, and then she gets abducted. It's like she is so abused in this film.
But she stands firm, man. She is, you know, she's still, well, it doesn't stand, but she sits
She figuratively stands.
Yes, yes. She's very self-empowered in this film, which I really like. I like that when she finds out that she's pregnant with possibly, you know, the Antichrist, first thing she does, just let's go over, let's get an abortion. No hesitancy whatsoever. Can't say the same thing for, Rosemary or anybody else who's been carrying the spawn of Satan around.
Well, she already had one spawn of Satan, so she just does not need another.
Yeah, which is kind of weird because it's like they keep talking about when she has a son, then that's going to be the whole thing. But it's like, man, you know, the daughter is bad enough here.
This movie is so weird. I don't do drugs, Mike. I never have. I would really like to see this movie on acid sometime and just see what happened. Because this movie's like watching a movie on acid while you're straight.
No, it totally is. There is that kind of disconnect between all the things that are going on with it. You know, they do some very clever filmmaking things. You know, there are some parts of it where I'm just like, wow, that was really smart that they did that. Like the interrogation that Glenn Ford has with all the different people about the ill-fated birthday party that Katie has. And I love the way that they kind of are going back and forth between his head and the people that he's interviewing, kind of using those to cut, you know, as a nice device for that. But then there are other parts where I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? I guess it's just like when characters just kind of show up out of nowhere, like Shelley Winters or like Glenn Ford. And it's like, where did this person come from? And it just feels, yeah, like there's that whole disconnect going on.
Well, and then you find out that Shelley Winters and John Huston have some sort of their co-workers or something there to protect Joanne Nail. And they do a pretty crappy job considering how much we've already talked about how abused she is in this. They don't do the best job protecting her, but they keep saying that's their job.
Do you know what that word protect means, maybe?
It means maybe stop her from getting pushed through a fish tank or shot in the spine or hung from a staircase.
The guy that produced this, you were talking about him a little bit earlier, and I'm going to trip over his name now. It's my turn. Ovidio Asinitis, which sounds like a disease or something. He also produced one called Beyond the Door, which is called Kisei in Italian. And, you know, you're talking about the fish tank, and that movie right there has like this big fish tank scene in it too, and it's just like, okay, he must have had some things that he was trying to work out. And the whole thing of trying to impregnate Joanne Nail with the, you know, the next Antichrist and everything, and just the way Katie is in the film, kind of definitely not as extreme as Reagan, but definitely having some, you know, satanic powers as if she were possessed. You know, it feels like this is kind of a mashup of that film, Beyond the Door, and then also Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist all together.
I'd throw The Omen, and we've already talked about it, but Close Encounters, definitely. And the Close Encounters stuff comes out of nowhere because even though they're from space, it's not really a science fiction movie until this almost UFO scene just kind of happens.
Well, and then that's the bad guys, too, which you don't really assume that the bad guys are coming from space. But yeah, all those guys coming out in their like white outfits with those weird helmets on and stuff, it kind of reminded me of the bad guys from like Spaceballs.
Well, and then also they were using technology that the 70s did not possess.
Right.
They were using definitely futuristic or, you know, Star Wars type technology. You know, the fact that Katie gets, for lack of a better term, cured at the end of the film, I guess means maybe I'm reading way too much into this, but like the duality of man that, you know, you're not good or evil. It's how you use it. Or maybe I'm reading way more into it than I should.
All right. So we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
Heading west on the long, lonely highway, only his dreams for company, until...
told me never to do this.
Before many miles, you wish he'd taken his mom's advice. When Jim Halsey let the hitcher into his car, he opened the doors of hell.
What do you want?
I want you to stop me.
Once you've met the hitcher, you'll never pick up another.
My wallet's in my pocket.
Shut up! We know how to do it.
Jesus!
Why are you doing this to me?
You're a smart kid. Figure it out.
I didn't do it. I didn't do any of it. I'm not a killer. This morning, this guy tried to kill me, and he's been following me ever since.
Why didn't he kill us?
Hi, kid.
I don't want to die!
The terror starts the moment you stop for the hitcher.
What do you want?
I want you to stop me.
Be sure to tune in next week. I'll be joined by Josh Johnson and Brian Kelly as we talk about The Hitcher. I want to thank this week's guest, Josh Hadley, for stopping by. So tell me what's been going on with your many podcasts, Lost in the Static, Radiodrome, What the Fuck, and that column that you've been writing.
Lost in the Static, Radiodrome, What the Fuck all air on jackaloperadio.com, which if you're listening to this show, Mike's a fellow Jackalope Radio host, so you should be able to find him pretty easily.
Go, Jackalope Radio, go!
And then my column called Sanity is Razor Thin comes out every Monday on geekjuicemedia.com, and it's whatever happens to be pissing me off that week, and I write about it.
Is there anything that's pissing you off right now?
As we record this, the one I just wrote was how Kevin Smith's Comic Book Men series is basically blackface for comic fans.
Yeah, I haven't really read a whole lot of good things about that show.
It's insulting. It really is insulting.
And what's going on with the podcast at the moment? Are there any special episodes folks should be looking out for? If folks haven't listened to your many podcasts, you want to give a little breakdown as far as like what they can expect when they go there?
Lost in the Static is more of a look back at nostalgia. We look at older computer things, cartoons, music. That one's kind of a crapshoot. Radiodrome is more about movies, and we got the current controversy over Jared being let go that is kind of eating up the show right now. And then on What the Fuck, it's a current event show, and we've added the heart attack segment by Hart D. Fisher of Boneyard Press, which is getting a lot of positive feedback. And Hart Fisher is bringing back the Marvel Can Suck My t-shirts to help out the real creator of Ghost Rider. So check out the current What the Fucks, and you'll hear us talking about how the creator of Ghost Rider got screwed by Marvel and how you can buy a Marvel Can Still Suck My t-shirt.
All right, so be sure to visit Josh's stuff over at 1201 Beyond. That's 1201beyond.com for Josh's podcast, and catch more of The Projection Booth at iTunes, Stitcher, over at Jackalope, jackaloperadio.com, where you can find Josh's stuff as well, or visit for more Projection Booth, that is, visit projection-booth.com. And, oh, hey, Josh, don't forget about that present that I got you.
Oh, cool. Okay, let me open this. Neat!